Straight from the source tonight, full steam ahead. The stage now set for opening statements in the historic first criminal trial of Donald Trump, with a full jury seated in just 4 days, to the great dismay of the criminal defendant, who openly wants it all to just slow down. Plus, even more angst for Trump. New York's attorney general now asking a judge to throw out the $175 million bond Trump posted in his civil fraud case. Could the former president's assets now be at risk again? That court hearing, get this, set for Monday morning, while Trump is in criminal court just down the street. And the Republican House Speaker in even more jeopardy tonight, as a third member of Mike Johnson's conference signs on to the effort to oust him, meaning he could need Democrats to step in and save his job. I'm John King, in for Caitlin Collins. This is The Source. Donald Trump's first criminal trial is about to get real, much more intense, with opening statements now set for Monday. At the heart of it, a hush money payment to a former porn star just before the 2016 election that put Trump in the White House. Phase one, now in the history books. 12 jurors, 6 alternates are in place. That full jury impaneled after a 4-day process that, yes, had a few bumps in the road, but overall, things did move quickly, something the former president does not sound very happy about.
The trial starts on Monday, which is long before a lot of people thought. The judge wants us to go as fast as possible. That's for his reasons, not for my reasons. And this is really a concerted witch hunt, very simple. Everything you heard in there, this is a witch hunt by numerous judges, Democrat judges.
Judge Von Mershon does seem to want to move things along, but that's how it works. There is no proof, zero proof, of a witch hunt. Day four also included a heated debate over what the former president could be asked about if he chooses to testify. How much, for example, of his past legal issues can be brought up during cross-examination, like the E. Jean Carroll case, his civil fraud verdict. Trump's lawyers objecting to all of it. The judge said he'd rule on that by Monday.
Trump, are you going to testify? Yes.
Answer, yes, but testifying would be extremely risky for the former president. So we'll see. We'll see in the days ahead if that actually happens. The judge also gave the Trump defense team a stern warning today. Stop filing motions, he said, to try to relitigate decisions already made. The judge saying, quote, that has to end. Accept my rulings. Let's get straight to my legal sources tonight. With me to talk this over, criminal defense attorney, CNN legal analyst Joey Jackson, former federal prosecutor David Kelly, who served as the U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, and 2 veteran New York attorneys, Renato Strabile, Arthur Idala. Well, let's get straight to the question. Joey, on Monday it starts. This process was important, and we'll talk a little bit more about the jury selection process and what we learned, but on Monday it starts. So what is happening right now? Each side spends the weekend thinking, first impression, matter, you want to win the jury on day one, right?
Yeah, without question, John, and it doesn't start this weekend. Certainly it started months ago, right? Because Monday is about your narrative. And so I think we know what the narrative of the prosecution will be. We've heard it. It's been laid out in the statement of facts that the prosecutor has already indicated. I expect Monday for them to go at it and really lay out to the jury what is their theory, to talk to them about what this scheme was all about, to talk to them about the players involved in the scheme, to talk to them about the evidence they have to substantiate it. And I also, John, do believe that they're going to talk about the issue of corroboration. We know they'll go after attack Michael Cohen. He's a liar. He's a perjurer. That won't happen Monday. But I think that through their testimony in jury selection, they've conditioned the jury to having unsavory witnesses. And I think they'll talk about, don't only rely upon our witnesses, rely upon the text messages, the emails. But last point, and that is the defense. What'll be curious to me is to know how much they're going to commit. Will we see a defense, or will we see it's not about Donald Trump? Keep an open mind. They have to establish it through reasonable doubt. This is nothing to do with politics. I want to know whether they lay out a defense that is the defense team, or whether they keep it generic and general.
Well, let's break it down more sharply. Let's start with the prosecution. You're a prosecutor. No prosecutor has done what's going to happen Monday morning. Prosecutors are going to stand up and ask a jury to convict a former president of the United States. How important is it to come out of the box and frame the case?
Very important. I mean, there's the opportunity for the prosecutors to kind of lay out a roadmap for the case. And part of this case really is not so challenging in the sense that you have to prove, you know, the falsified records and so forth. You have to prove the criminal intent of the defendant. But I think most important, you have to prove the so what. That's not a legal requirement. It's really a factual requirement. Why should we care? Why is it such a big deal? So that's number one, that I think that's one of the biggest hurdles here. The second thing is I go into the opening statement. What I'm going to do is, you know, somewhat you said, which is to, I want to bait the defendant a little bit, get him to say more than he needs to say, because defendants don't have to say much of anything. The burden's not on them. But you want them to try to commit to something that you are pretty sure or you can prevent them from accomplishing at the end of the trial.
And so what about the defense perspective?
Yeah. Oh, I'm going to stand right up. I'm going to say, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, you know what the evidence is going to show? The evidence is going to show that Stormy Daniels tried to shake down, blackmail Donald Trump. What the evidence is going to show, she's the criminal in the courtroom. She's the one who shook him down. Oh, and just in case you want to know the other criminals in the courtroom, oh, the main witness is, he's the guy who did time in jail. We'll hear about Otisville. We'll hear about where he slept and what the meals that he ate when he was in jail. That's who they want you to rely upon to put the president of the United States in jail, and they're going to fail miserably.
How much does this matter, the tension we've seen between the judge and the defense team? It's in the pretrial phase. It's in the jury selection phase. But if it carries over into the trial, it can get interesting. This is Judge Mershon today talking about, you know, he keeps issuing rulings and the Trump team essentially moves the semicolon around and appeals it again. And they file it again and they challenge it again. The judge saying that has to end. There comes a point where you accept my rulings. I've entertained your motions. I've entertained your arguments in good faith. At some point, you need to accept my motions. Trump was glaring at the judges that went through. Does that matter? Does it matter?
I mean, it does matter. You don't want to be in the courtroom and the jury getting the impression that the judge is against you. So people have to be careful. You don't want to be angering the judge. But on the other hand, you can't stop people from doing their job. You can't stop people from filing motions. They have to make a record. They may have to make an appeal here. So they're just doing their job.
But we heard his one-word answer, yes, when the former president was asked if he would testify. We've had this conversation before. But if he testifies, now the judge still has to make his decision on the so-called Sandoval rule. What can the prosecution bring into cross-examination? But among the potential things, the E. Jean Carroll case, a lawsuit that was ruled frivolous that Trump brought against Hillary Clinton, a $450 million civil fraud judgment, October 23 gag order violation in that case. So you don't think he's ever going to get on the stand, right?
No, but let me just say from a legal perspective, because it's very timely and it is a little personal. Any minute, we're expecting the New York State Court of Appeals to hand out a ruling in the case of People's State of New York versus Harvey Weinstein, which my firm tried and argued. And that is, it's on Sandoval. It's on that exact issue. And that Court of Appeals ruling is going to tell everyone in the state how much you can put in and what you cannot put in. So Tuesday is actually a possibility when that ruling could come down. And it could cause this trial judge to adjust his ruling depending on what the highest court in the state says.
But I think there's a distinction, Arthur, from the excellent representation that you provided for him. And
Thank
I think that there, without question, known Arthur for a long time, exceptional lawyer. The reality, though, is that in your case, there was just so much that was let in with respect to prior bad acts of sexual conduct when the case was about sexual conduct. Here, they're going after Trump, yes, on fraud issues as it relates to business records, but there's so much more. The violation of orders. Sir, you know what orders are, and you continue to violate them. Why isn't that fair game? Issues relating to defamation and issues relating to E. Jean Carroll. So I think there's a distinction between the numerous sexual allegations let in your case and what could be let in this case.
And we have seen, including in the courtroom today, when E. Jean Carroll came up, Trump was shaking his head and you saw the energy. But in the public sphere, we've seen even worse. And we've seen the language. And we've seen, you know, just the caustic things, the hostile, the horrible things he says about her. Would that be a gift to prosecutors if he actually took the stand?
Yeah, I think we can all focus on the cross-examination, what they let in, what they don't let in. But I think from a prosecutor's standpoint, take that all away. I don't even really care what they let me cross-examine about, because given his history and what he's done before, I don't know that he can stand up and even on direct appear to be credible in the face of all the other evidence.
And yet I've been saying this all week, I'm a contrarian on this issue to a degree. The guy got 77 million votes. He doesn't have to convince that many people in the jury box.
I always go with three. Because legally, it's one, right? It's a hung jury. But three, you can't get bullied by the other ones, and you stay strong. And, you know, we know we have that one juror on there who she already says, I don't like Trump. I don't like the way he treats people. I think he's selfish. So I'm not even looking for an acquittal. I'm looking for a hung jury.
And she has the most star power of anybody in that courtroom by far. And some of these jurors, if they have mixed feelings or if they kind of like him, they might be totally starstruck by him and might be, you know, anticipating him to testify.
So they'll disregard the evidence? I mean, the reality is, starstruck or not, it comes down to the oath you take as a juror. And that oath requires that you follow the law. And there are multiple counts here. So are they going to say, with respect to every count, there's nothing to see here? That ledger's fine. That invoice is fine. I just don't know.
Well, there are 34 counts, but there's only one lie. Right. It's just the same lie repeated over and over again. But we know that jurors decide cases based often on emotion and then they back into the logic. So he could do himself a favor by testifying.
So then how does the defense team work this out then? I assume, despite what their client says, that they start this thinking we'd like to keep him off the stand. How do you make that calculation as you go? If you think you're losing, you say, OK, let's roll the dice. Let's put the politician in there to win a vote. Is that how you do it?
Yeah, let's put it this way. If it's going well for them, if cross-examination, they blow these guys to smithereens, you're turning around and telling your client, no way do you get on that stand. Now, obviously, this is a difficult trial client to control. And ultimately, whether or not to testify is a client's decision, not the lawyer's decision. So it's anybody's guess how this is going to
happen. Help me with the opening statements calculation. It's been a long time, but I used to sit in courtrooms. And sometimes the prosecution gives this long laundry list. And it might all be great. It might all be substantive. They might have a great case, but they lose the jury. They just put them up. And you see other cases where they just come in and say, we're going to have a lot to talk about over the next 6 weeks. Here are the five or six things you need to know today. Boom, 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 boom. Move on. What do you do here?
I would do that, because what you really want to give them is an overall, a 10,000 foot view, and you want to give them a roadmap. You want to give them kind of inflection points, just points of reference, so they know what's going on as it happens. To go into the details and give them the whole long-winded story without any context, not going to work.
I go my cousin Vinny. I stand up there and say, what he just said is BS. No, I think you got to go up there forcefully, passionately. Right. And what Joey Jackson mentioned last night, I think when we were on, is about jury nullification. Sometimes you can, in a case like this, with passion and reason, you could say, yeah, they proved their case. Walk him out of here. You determine what justice is.
And so then help me with the second level. He's up making the opening argument for the defense. He did the prosecution. You're the other lawyer at the table. What are you doing? You're watching him or you're watching the jury trying to figure out who's doing what?
I'm watching both, but I'm not a big believer in watching body language or facial expressions, because we've all had the experience. A juror nods at you throughout the entire, and then you lose. So it's something that doesn't really work.
You know, it's funny, because you'll sometimes be watching a jury the whole trial, could be months long, and you think, you know, I got this juror. At the end of the day, that's the one you didn't have.
Everybody here has had that experience.
It means nothing. I think they keep it thematic, right? I think that's how you captivate your audience. You keep it really generic, just giving them a sense of what you'll do. But I'm looking for what the defense will do. And at the end of the day, quickly, you can talk about Michael Cohen being a perjurer. You can talk about Stormy Daniels being unsavory. Do you have corroborations? Was a shell company established or not? Are there text messages indicating that this was a game plan or not? Are there emails? Are there other things that show that what you're saying, is unsavory as you are? Listen, it's true, because there are other things to establish that. Well, that's going to be a significant thing here.
We throw around historic and unprecedented. We use those words too often. This is truly historic and unprecedented. We'll see you on Monday. Gentlemen, appreciate all your time tonight. Thank you so much. It was a dramatic and emotional day in court for some of the prospective jurors, too. Two broke down in tears, understandably feeling the weight of it all. Up next, the pressures on the shoulders of the jurors, with the legendary White House counsel John Dean, who knows a bit about what it's like to feel the heat. And later, did Trump post a bad bond for his $175 million fraud fine? Why New York's attorney general is now asking a judge to void it?
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent. This week on Chasing Life...
Lately, we have been paying attention to a very different virus, bird flu, which is caused by the H5N1 virus. If you start to hear that it's circulating in pigs, that would be a concern.
That means I would go from sleeping with one eye open to one and a half eyes open. Yeah, that would make me very concerned.
Listen to Chasing Life, wherever you get your podcasts.
Donald Trump's first criminal trial is already a pressure cooker, including for the 18 New Yorkers who had no idea they would be part of history when they opened a seemingly routine summons to jury duty. The 12 jurors and the 6 alternates, survivors now in an incredibly tense selection process that even in its final day pushed some finalists to their breaking point. One potential juror, for example, was excused by Judge Mershon today after she burst into tears, telling the court, quote, I'm sorry, I thought I could do this. I don't want you to feel I've wasted anyone's time. This is so much more stressful than I thought. Shortly after, she was dismissed. But the question now for the 18 chosen to remain, with the pressure this high, can they keep it together? Will they follow the rules? Joining me tonight, someone who's no stranger to high-pressure moments in American history, the former Richard Nixon White House counsel, John Dean. John, it's great to see you. You know, we spent a lot of time, what's at stake for Donald Trump? The tension between the judge and the lawyers, the prosecutor who's going to stand up and try to put a former president of the United States in jail. It's never happened before. But what about these 12 ordinary Americans who have to sit there, who are now part of huge history, and they have enormous pressure and also enormous stakes?
Well, they must feel it, especially by the fact they're anonymous. And they know that. They know that their identity is being withheld. In fact, one of them resigned from the jury pool when she found out she had been uncovered by media coverage in general, and others figured out it was her. So, yes, they're under a lot of pressure. They know what's ahead. It's a big decision they're going to have to make at some point when they deliberate on whether this man is guilty or innocent. So, yes, I'm sure there's a lot of pressure, and we'll see how they handle it.
So one of the potential jurors raised her hand in the middle of the questioning, said she was feeling extremely anxious. She, too, was removed. Emotional turmoil. But, you know, when Trump was president, we all lived it through his tweets. Now you have 12 people, 18 people, if you count the alternates, in a box there. If you were in that courtroom, what would you be looking for every day? Or if you were a fellow juror, what would you be looking for in your peers, your colleagues every day?
Well, you know, juries are hard to observe, as your panel initially noted. Some jurors nod at lawyers, some smile at defendants and what have you. That's not a very good read, because when they get into deliberations, other things seem to happen. As you read the history of jury service, and I've read a number of books that have addressed this, it varies from jury to jury, but they take on their own chemistry and their own personality. So this jury is so young, we don't really have a read on it. But these are a bunch of strangers who don't know each other, who are going to be very intimate for probably at least 6, if not more, weeks.
And you have personal experience at this, being involved in something high pressure that involves the words, the President of the United States. How does that make it different? How does it make it more intense?
Well, I think the parallel you're referring to is I was the key witness for the government in U.S. versus Mitchell, Haldeman, Ehrlichman et al., which were the former attorney general, chief of staff of Nixon, his top domestic advisors, and others involved in the Watergate cover-up. And the president was a co-conspirator in that. He had been pardoned so that he could not be indicted, but he was a co-conspirator. There was a lot of pressure on that jury. In fact, the jury was sequestered by the judge. I wouldn't be surprised if this jury gets sequestered also, given the pressure they're under. It's not from Donald Trump that the pressure is going to come. It's from his followers and his over-exuberant supporters at times. We know what they did in the Capitol. We know that they can be activated. We know that he called for them to come and demonstrate. So sequestering this jury would not be an out-of-order sort of arrangement. And then they would become even more intimate.
Right, it also becomes more stressful, though. You take people away from their family for a matter of weeks, which I think the judge at the beginning.
Yes, it does.
Yeah, at the beginning, the judge has tried to say, let's see if we can do this the quote-unquote normal way. But that means they're not supposed to talk about a case that involves the former president of the United States. That means they're not supposed to post or look at social media in a case that involves the former president of the United States. So it's incredibly difficult. And this has come up. Trump was listening intensely. Another potential juror shared she was worried she'd be disqualified because of a prior criminal conviction. And Judge Merchan said this. We heard from a very brave woman who shared very personal things about her life. I know that wasn't easy to do in a room full of strangers. Please be kind to this person. What's your perspective? You know, kind, that's a message to Donald Trump, the defendant, who sometimes scowls at people, who sometimes also could be quite charming with people if you're in a room with him. But it's also a message to people in our business to be careful about what we do disclose about these people, right?
Exactly. That's been one of the problems. There's often been an overreaction or a reaction to Trump's baiting of the media. And we know that the right-wing media has been more than willing to be his defender, to go out and go after these people. Fox News has already targeted this jury, claiming that liberal activists are slipping onto it. So that's just all baloney. There's no basis for it. And it's very early in the process. And I think we have a good judge, John, who will be able to handle this with equanimity and justice.
Well, we start that second phase on Monday. John Dean, grateful for your perspective tonight. Thank you, sir. And as John was noting about the high pressure here today and all the focus here today, just as the jury was being sworn in today, a man lit himself on fire outside the courthouse. A horrific, disturbing incident that, yes, now only heightening security concerns. That's next. Tonight, New York police say they're reviewing security measures around Donald Trump's trial, that after a Florida man lit himself on fire right across the street from the courthouse. Police say that man now in critical condition. This was the scene after he was removed, smoke still billowing. The motive is unclear, but officials say the man did throw pamphlets about conspiracy theories into the air before dousing himself with a liquid and setting himself on fire. As people screamed and ran from the area, remember Donald Trump just yards away inside the courthouse as lawyers vetted the final set of alternate jurors. My legal sources are back with me. Joey, let's start with that. This is an extreme incident. We hope an isolated incident, but it does remind you big events like this can become a magnet for people who are trying to make some kind of a statement, whether it has anything to do with Donald Trump or not. Plus, there's the added factor of we have seen around events that involve Donald Trump before, protests, many of them peaceful, yeah. But it's going to be an episode.
Without question, John. And, you know, that brings to mind the issue of the gag order that will be addressed on Tuesday. Why? Because the whole nature and purpose of the gag order is to protect people, to not have the president with the bully pulpit that he has, former president, and so many followers who believe in him, who like him, you know, some hate him, some love him. But people are moved to action. And if you talk about certain people that you shouldn't talk about, like the judge's family and others, if you talk about witnesses, if you talk about jurors, there could be consequences. We pray not. But in response to your question, when you see issues like this, it brings to mind the realities of what Tuesday's hearing about the gag order is all about. You incite people to action, and this could be the result.
Let's go back to the conversation I was having with John Dean about the jurors. He says maybe the judge should sequester them. The judge has decided not to do that. I think for humanity reasons, you're taking these people away from their families, their lives. This is going to be stressful enough. You want them to go home, sleep in their own bed, see their own children, partners, friends, and things like that. How does that balance out, though? What are the risks? Is that the right thing to do in a high-profile case, and what are the risks?
Well, look, I think, you know, a happy juror is a thoughtful juror, number one. Number two, if Judge Marchand wants this case to move along and he decided to sequester a jury at the outset, we wouldn't be talking about opening statements come Monday. So I think, look, they're anonymous and they can take steps to protect them and protect their identity. So they should take every effort they can short of sequestering to keep this trial moving. John Dean is right. There may come a time, there may be events that unfold that may say, hey, look, I'm going to have to sequester you. But for now, I think he's on the right course to try to keep things in place and on pace.
So walk us through the rules. How anywhere in the world, but especially in Manhattan, do you essentially ask people to go off the grid?
It's very difficult, but that's what the instruction will be. Do not look at any media about this case. Do not read about this case. Do not talk about this case. The other thing is the jurors are not going to be able to discuss the case until they enter their deliberations. And that's very difficult because that's the main thing happening in your life. So when Michael Cohen takes the stand, of course, they're naturally going to want to talk about that, but they can't. They have to talk about other things like sports or the weather. So it's a very challenging situation.
Can you expect these people? I mean, this is one of those things online. You go online, let's say you think you're going to do sports. No matter where you go, this is going to be. How do you, I guess, if you just see it, what's your responsibility? Judge, I was doing something. I thought I was following the rules. It popped up. I didn't dwell on it. I took it off. How do you work that out?
Yeah, that has happened where a juror comes in and fesses up that they saw something. But it's really the method of technology. It's like there are these pop-ups. So they're not even trying to do it. In terms of sequestration, John, you know, when I was a kid, jurors during deliberations were sequestered, like I think in B and A felonies. So once the judge charged the jury or the day before, he'd say, bring your overnight bag. Once you start deliberating, I'm locking you in. I don't think that would be such a bad idea here for either side to say, hey, once the case is in the jury's hands, let's really protect them and put them in a hotel with the court officers.
And until then, help me understand, each of you may have different perspectives. So a juror violates the rules. you know, maybe it's a small violation. If it's a big violation, I assume everybody agrees that juror has to go. That's why you have alternates. But if it is just something popped up, or, you know, I told my husband not to talk to me about it, but he did, you know, how do you then make an assessment of, you're going to ask the judge?
The judge usually calls him in one-on-one. Yeah. You go in the back, you go in the judge's robing room. Everyone's there, all the active participants. And you see, it's really about a matter of degree. And then both sides take a position. If it was a person in jury selection you didn't like, this is your opportunity to say, judge, you got to throw them off. It's someone you liked. Judge, it wasn't such a big deal.
But also the judge might want to err on the side of getting rid of the juror because, you know, if you keep the juror, you're creating appellate issues. And the court wants to avoid that.
But it always depends upon the nature of the violation. And you always get called to the principal's office, that is the judge, and then you explain what goes on. And I think we could expect and anticipate, that's why we have alternates, things are going to arise. A court officer is going to hear some discussion for the jurors. As you noted, Ronald, they're not supposed to talk. I heard them speaking together. They were talking about Michael Cohen. They were talking about Stormy Daniels. Issues will arise. It'll be up to the judge to determine whether it reaches a degree to get them off the jury.
I think the bottom line is the judge has to determine in the exchange with the juror, notwithstanding everything, can you still be fair and listen to just the facts and decide on the law as I instruct you? And the judge is going to have to evaluate the credibility of the juror, whether or not they can, in fact, do that.
I assume there's going to be a lot of wow walking out of the courtroom, but that's not talking about it, right? If you just say, wow, what a day, right? That's fair enough. That juror can stay.
You're allowed to say wow.
Let's see.
Not much more.
These guys don't agree on much. We got a full unanimous agreement. You can say wow. Joey Jackson, David Kelly, Renato Stabile. Arthur Idala, thanks so much for your time, gentlemen. Thank you. Have a great weekend. A revolt to oust the House Speaker, Mike Johnson, now picking up steam. He may soon need Democrats to throw him a lifeline. And, yes, drumroll please, speaking of bad blood, Taylor Swift is spilling it in a big way on her new double album that's already breaking records in just one day. She just dropped the first music video from it this evening, and she set off, yes, a Swifty frenzy.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
A big win for the House Speaker Mike Johnson, yet it could cost him his job. The House will convene in a rare Saturday session tomorrow to pass a foreign aid package backed by the Speaker. Today's win was a procedural vote, only made possible after Democrats, in an extraordinary move, sided with the Republican Speaker, Mr. Johnson, to offset Republican no votes. Among those no's was Republican Congressman Paul Gosar of Arizona. He now is the third House Republican member publicly on the record supporting a motion to vacate the chair, meaning fire Johnson as Speaker. Joining me now to discuss is New York Republican Congressman Mike Lawler, whose committee assignments include the Foreign Affairs Committee. And let's start there, Congressman. A lot of drama to discuss, a lot of theater, but the substance. Are you convinced now, after this vote today, and you're coming in tomorrow, that the money for Ukraine, the money for Israel, the money for Taiwan will finally, after months of debate and a lot of drama, clear the Congress?
John, before we start, I just want to say I'm not wearing a tux because you're filling in tonight. I'm at the Moldovan American Convention gala, so that's why I'm in a tux. But let me just say this is critically important. You know, today I spoke before the Moldovan American Convention. They're very concerned about what is happening in Ukraine. We need to lead. The United States is the leader of the free world. We cannot shirk in our responsibility. And I think the Speaker deserves a lot of credit for putting this on the floor, knowing full well it could cost him his job as Speaker, but it's the right thing to do. Russia, China, and Iran are engaged in an unholy alliance that seeks to undermine and destabilize the free world. And ensuring that our allies, Israel, Ukraine, and Taiwan get the aid that they need is critical, not just for the future of the world, but America's role in it. And I think putting this bill on the floor, getting it passed in a broad bipartisan vote tomorrow is essential. I think the Speaker in the end will be fine because he's doing what is right by the country and by the institution. And I think all of us, Republicans and Democrats, need to take the opportunity to also do what is right and not throw this House into chaos by joining in with a handful of malcontents and removing the Speaker.
You say you think he'll be fine. You have three already, and you have a whole bunch of others who are disgruntled. Who knows if they would vote to vacate. But if he's going to be fine, is he going to need Democrats to survive, at least for now, if they file that motion?
Absolutely. I mean, look, it's a reality of the math. In order to remove the Speaker, you need all of the Democrats to join in, as we saw with the removal of Kevin McCarthy. And I think it's incumbent upon everybody, Republicans and Democrats, to uphold the institution and say, we're not going to partake in this. We're not going to join in on this chaos with the Matt Gaetzes of the world or the Marjorie Taylor Greens or Paul Gosar. We are going to do what's right. The Speaker is making a very courageous decision. Yes, it's his job. But as we've all seen, it's not always easy to do the right thing. And he's doing it. Political consequences be damned. And I think that's something that people should respect within the institution and recognize that, look, removing the Speaker is not going to result in a Democratic Speaker. We have a Republican majority. It will be another Republican. But throwing the House into chaos for another 3 weeks or maybe even more this time around is not in the interest of the American people. And that's something that I think all of us have to recognize collectively.
One of the reasons, the principal reason, Marjorie Taylor Greene says she wants to remove Speaker Johnson is because of the Ukraine issue. She says he's with the Democrats. I came to Washington when Ronald Reagan was president. It was a very different Republican Party back in those days. You're in the room. We see what is said publicly. We see what is said on the floor. You're in the private rooms. I just want you to listen here to Marjorie Taylor Greene, who sounds like she's a Kremlin spokesman, and then Speaker Johnson with very different perspectives on what's at stake here.
Vladimir Putin has not said he wants to go march across Europe and take Europe.
I think that Vladimir Putin would continue to march through Europe if he were allowed. I think he might go to the Balkans next. I think he might have a showdown with Poland or one of our NATO allies.
The Speaker's view is your view, which I think is still the majority view among House Republicans, but not like it used to be. That minority is growing and it is very vocal. What goes on in the closed door session when you stand up and say, what the hell are you saying?
Well, you know, Anderson, the reason I'm at the Moldovan American Convention tonight is my wife is from Moldova. Her family lives on the Ukraine border. I know full well the consequence of failure in Ukraine. It means a country like Moldova, which doesn't have a military, will fall. Vladimir Putin has made it very clear that he would invade Moldova, and he is trying to rebuild the former Soviet Union. I think the vast majority of Congress and the Republican Conference understands the threat we are facing. This is not in a silo. You have Iran, Russia, and China that have engaged in an unholy alliance that seeks to undermine and destabilize the United States, Israel, Europe, and the free world. When you look at the situation with Iran, for instance, you have a country that is the greatest state sponsor of terror. They fund Hamas 93% of their budget. They fund Hezbollah, the Houthis, and other terrorist organizations. You know where they get the money from? They get the money from China. China purchases Iranian petroleum. 80% of its revenue comes from China. So this is something where in this bill tomorrow, my bill, the SHIP Act, the Iran-China Energy Sanctions Act, will be part of the bill to go after Iran and China. Look, Ronald Reagan's philosophy was very clear, peace through strength. America can keep peace in the world when it is strong, when our allies are strong, when we are supporting democracy. That is the objective. That is why I will proudly cast my vote tomorrow in favor of the bill that Speaker Johnson is putting on the floor. America must lead. We have no alternative. And if we shirk in this responsibility, you will see a new world order arise with Russia, China, and Iran leading the way, and that will be devastating for America economically and from a national security standpoint.
I suspect your view will carry the day tomorrow, but I also suspect you'll be back here next week talking about the fallout in the House of Representatives. Congressman, grateful for your time tonight. Thank you, sir.
Thanks, John.
And a big pivot here. This just in, Taylor Swift dropped the first music video of her new album. It's called Fortnite, and it features the tattooed rapper, Post Malone. Swift's double album, The Tortured Poets Department, has been out for less than 24 hours. Already, it is breaking records. According to Billboard, it's Spotify's most streamed album in a single day this year.
3, 2, 1. Oh my God.
I'm actually gonna vomit right now. So here are just brief thoughts. What are the titles? Are there features?
The Black Dark!
This is so good. This is so good.
One song. Thank you, Amy. Has listeners convinced Taylor's talking about Kim Kardashian? They've had bad blood since 2016. Yes, pun intended. For starters, check this out. This is the title of the song with just K-I-M, Kim, capitalized. And the song is about a high school bully, thrown punches, and Swift is left to deal with the searing pain. Many think it's about Kim Kardashian's verbal attacks. We'll keep you posted if there's any official response, and we'll bring you the Twitter videos about it too. I promise, TikTok videos too, as well. Ahead, not only is Donald Trump's trial about to really get going on Monday, he also faces a hearing on that $175 million bond he posted. Will it be voided? Why New York's attorney general says it's simply not good. At 9:30 Monday morning, we'll hear opening statements in Donald Trump's hush money criminal trial. And just a half an hour later, two blocks away, also in New York City, a different judge will consider throwing out the former president's $175 million bond. The New York Attorney General, Letitia James, filed paperwork saying she doesn't believe a single word of that agreement that Trump has with a company called Knight Specialty Insurance. That's the company putting up the bond. Now, before that hearing was even scheduled, Trump was already sounding off.
That case is a threat to democracy, frankly, what took place with the AG, a crooked AG, Letitia James, who campaigned on the fact that I'm going to get Trump. That's all she said for 2 years.
Joining me now is a journalist with years of reporting on Trump's finances, senior Forbes editor Dan Alexander. Dan, thank you for your time. Letitia James says essentially this is bogus. The deal doesn't meet the standards of how you have to put these things together. Does she have a point?
Well, there are some legitimate concerns here. The primary one is the nature of the collateral that's supporting this bond. So this is a $175 million bond. And on the night that it was posted, one of my colleagues at Forbes talked to Don Hankey, who's the billionaire behind the company that's helping Trump secure this bond. And he said that the collateral was a mixture of cash and investment grade bonds. But now in legal papers, his company is saying actually it's purely cash. And that's a big question, whether these are bonds supporting this or whether it's cash, because the value of bonds fluctuates in a way that cash doesn't. And the state wants to know whether or not that $175 million is truly secure.
And so what happens if the judge rules against Trump? Does he have to go out and find another bond company, come up with the cash himself?
Yeah, Trump's going to be fine here in the end of the story. He has more than $175 million in cash. Other companies will issue him a bond if this one doesn't. But it is a nuisance, and he might end up having to pay a higher fee. Knight Specialty Insurance was a company that actually reached out to him proactively. We don't know the nature of that agreement and exactly how much he's paying in fees, but it seems like a safe assumption that it was at the very least a fair market deal, if not a bit of a bargain. He might end up having to pay a little bit more if he has to go shop around and look at other firms.
If nothing else, these two proceedings, a few blocks apart, a half an hour apart, remind us that Trump has more than one, more than you can fit in a hand, maybe two hands, of legal issues. So there's that, just that how many he has. But is there any connection between these two cases?
Yeah, there certainly are. You know, some of the witnesses are the same between the civil fraud case and the criminal one. In fact, one of the key people in the criminal case is Alan Weisselberg, who was for a long time the CFO of Donald Trump's company. And you would expect him to be somebody who would testify in a way that would be beneficial to Trump. However, when he testified in the civil fraud case, he perjured himself and is now sitting on Rikers Island in jail for committing that perjury. So he's going to come to this case with all of that baggage that's going to undermine whatever testimony and credibility Trump's team is going to try to build up behind him.
And help me. You say Trump has maneuvered his portfolio a little bit. And he seems to be anticipating the need for some money. How so?
Yeah, if you look at their claim that this is $175 million in pure cash, and you compare that to what his portfolio was, you know, a couple of years ago, he wasn't sitting on $175 million of pure cash at that point. So he's clearly shifted things where he's more liquid and where he can be ready to outlay significant sums of money. He doesn't, however, have the amount of cash to pay the full judgment, which is north of $460 million at this point, although he can cover the bond, which is the lower $175 million figure.
See what happens in court on Monday. Dan Alexander, thanks very much.
Thank you.
This weekend, a new CNN film premiere, Blue Carbon, Nature's Hidden Power. Here's a preview.
Jada Guy is not your average scientist, though it started that way.
I got my undergrad in biology and ecology and my master's in environmental toxicology.
And what did you think you wanted to do with your life as a kid?
Oh, gosh, I wanted to be a professor. Like, I wanted to go the full academic route.
And then the clubs got you, or what happened?
Yeah,
with music?
I took a hard right turn and changed my life.
Music was the other love of her life. And when she began making it as DJ Jada G, a whole new career took off. She worked with megastars and booked gigs and festivals, all while finishing her master's on the effects of toxins on killer whales. The two loves merge in her film Blue Carbon, an immersive journey through the watery landscapes that serve as massive allies in fighting the climate crisis.
So Blue Carbon is basically these ecosystems that are amazing at pulling carbon out of the atmosphere and putting it deep into the ground.
You're saying this is Blue Carbon?
This is Blue Carbon. So yeah, it's not blue, it's brown, but it is Blue Carbon.
They're like 10 times better at it than the Amazon rainforest, for example. Those ecosystems are mangrove forests, seagrass meadows, and salt marshes. We were taking field recordings throughout the whole film. And then I took all those field recordings and made a song out of it, essentially. And you get to hear that song at the end of the film.
I want to make a new anthem for nature by recording the sounds of coastal habitats that we don't value enough.
Do you play these in festivals?
Yeah, yeah.
How do you connect your music audience with what you care about as a biologist, as an ecologist?
Incorporating those sounds automatically gives me something to talk about because people really care and they're interested.
There's your Jada G, the DJ persona, but then there's Jada the biologist, and that's a paradox at times,
yeah,
given the footprint, the energy use at festivals and all of that.
It definitely is a paradox. Like, I'm a touring DJ, I have to fly to my gigs, and so I have a big carbon footprint. And then there's this other part of me that's the environmentalist and has studied in nature for so many years. How I reconcile that is by using my platform to talk about climate change and the environment. And also, I want to lead as an example that we all have that paradox within ourselves. We all live on this planet. We all have things that we do, whether we're conscious of it or not, that hurt the environment just by existing in this society. And we're always kind of at odds, and that's okay. We can still be at paradox and still want to help and save the environment.
Right, and maybe instead of getting defensive, say maybe there's a better way to fill this want or need.
Exactly.
In a way that's better for all life.
Exactly. Right. When we bring down the defensiveness, it really opens everything up to have more discussions and, you know, solutions.
It's pretty interesting. Be sure to tune in. CNN Film presents Blue Carbon, Nature's Hidden Power. That premiere Sunday, 9 p.m. Eastern and Pacific, right here only on CNN. Thanks for your time tonight. Hope you have a great weekend. CNN News Night with Abby Phillip starts now.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country. Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.